From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Wednesday, July 23rd, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gunathchish. Hawa Tuk Signusum Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive. Or on KTO's Facebook and Instagram pages. Today, got bears? Well, you might be eligible to receive financial support to help build an electric fence from Defenders of Wildlife. We'll get the important news on how to do it. Interested in the field of infant and toddler development? Well, a successful childhood development apprentice program is looking for a new cohort. We get all the details on how you can get involved. And DeBoss is here. That's Chief Derek Boss from the Juno Police Department to share about the upcoming National Night Out, America's Night Out Against Crime event happening here in Juno on August 6th. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Sounds wild.
Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
On a warm summer night, a bear and her cub are running down the street in an Anchorage neighborhood. They've been causing a bit of trouble in past weeks, sneaking into yards and investigating trash cans and chicken coops. But they've just had a bad experience. They were drawn into a yard by the scent of chickens, but when the mother bear approached the chicken coop, she was zapped by an electric fence. The shock was a rude surprise, and she bolted with her startled cub at her heels. Bears hate getting shocked, and she and her cub are unlikely to return. In 2025, an increasing number of Anchorage, Eagle River, and Girdwood residents were raising poultry at home. However, people aren't the only ones with an interest in these backyard dwellers. Fish and Game received many reports of brown bears accessing or attempting to access chickens and other suburban livestock. Of the options available to help protect livestock, electric fences are one of the best. An electric fence can keep bears out of gardens or compost and away from buildings, chicken coops, and other animal enclosures. Be sure that weeds and vegetation don't grow up and touch the fence. A fence tester is an easy way to check to be sure a fence is working properly. The Fish and Game website offers videos, advice, and tips on how to use an electric fence. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. And That Sounds Wild is a perfect lead-in to today's first guest. I'm joined now virtually by Isabel Grant, who is with Defenders for Wildlife. The organization does a variety of things, but today we are talking about bears and how we can coexist all together. Gunathchish Igudi, thank you so much, Isabel, for joining me on this lovely Wednesday afternoon, July 23rd. How are you today? Gunathchish, wasiati.
Hello. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I am doing well today. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's so good to be in the studio and to have you joining us virtually. Where are you at right now, Isabel? Where are you based?
I'm based in Anchorage, and we're having a really lovely day today, so I hope that Juno is experiencing the same. The sunshine is nice.
It turned a little gray and a little rainy right now, but we have been having some good weather which is nice since it's been pretty much a summer of rain, but it's all good. That's how it goes sometimes. Now, tell me, we've had you on the show the last couple summers talking about this electric fence incentive program, but let's first remind everybody about Defenders of Wildlife, what that organization is, and what you do.
Yeah, so Defenders of Wildlife is a national nonprofit organization. And broadly, our mission is to protect all native plants and animals in their natural communities. In reference to our bear coexistence work, it is specifically to help individuals and communities better share the landscape with bears using tools and strategies that help prevent conflict with bears in and around their natural habitats. And like many of us know, our homes, our trails, places where we recreate, places where we live, they're often right within bear habitat. So we really are living in and amongst bears.
Well, and it is interesting, and that sounds wild that Riley Woodford does from the State Department of Fish and Game. It's really interesting because he was talking about how people are, you know, they're growing more stuff in their garden. There's all these people up in Anchorage and the surrounding communities that might have chickens or other livestock that might be happening around the state. And those are attractors, let's say, for bears, right?
Yes, yeah. Bears like many of the same things that we do. So they're definitely interested in many of these, you know, food sources that we'll have around our house for our use. And they love them. You know, they love chickens. Bears will get into people's gardens. I think sometimes it's a misconception that there are vegetables and things that bears won't be into, but bears will eat that stuff as well. Pet food, livestock feed, compost, and of course your garbage, things like that. Those are all very attractive to bears because they're very low effort ways for them to continue to get calories throughout the summer as they're preparing for that winter denning period.
Now, we want to, and part of the mission of Defenders of Wildlife is to, in essence, coexist, right? We're not trying to get rid of the bears, but we're trying to figure out how we can all share and occupy the same space. Because I'm imagining that you know the facts or the figures or the whys of, you know, what do bears offer in sort of the, you know, ecological climate, and why are they important?
Yeah, well, one of the big things is bears are seed dispersers, almost as important as birds in the ecosystem, spreading around seeds from various berry producing plants, helping to fertilize the soil for trees and for plants to uptake nitrogen from salmon as they spread those carcasses around, both beside river streams but also deeper into the forest. Those carcasses also provide resources for scavengers, birds, smaller mammals. So they are really integral to the ecosystem, and they help kind of shape the ecosystem around Southeast Alaska, which then people kind of depend upon for their food sources, for recreation, for, you know, tourism as well. So bears are very much, you know, tied to our lives.
We like them. We do like them. Yes. We just don't want to necessarily run into them alone on a trail somewhere. That's all.
Yeah, exactly.
So your work at Defenders of Wildlife, what is it that you do, and when did you get started with them? Hello? Can you hear me?
Hi, so sorry about that. I think my Wi-Fi kind of cut out on me for a second there.
Oh, that's okay. It's all good. I was just asking, like, your work with the Defenders of Wildlife, what is the work that you do, and how long have you been doing it with them?
Yeah, so I basically manage Defenders of Wildlife's bear coexistence projects. So that includes the electric fence incentive program, and that also includes various efforts to help supply communities with other resources that can prevent conflict with bears. So things like electrified mats, bear-resistant garbage cans, and food storage lockers. And I have been with Defenders for about 3 years now. My first year was as an independent contractor, so I've been a full-time employee for around 2 years.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's awesome. Well, let's get to this program, and you can find out more about it at defenders.org/got-bears. I love the slogan. It's a wonderful play on the old got milk, right? Really awesome. So this electric fence incentive program, break it down for us. What is it, and why do we want to do it?
Yeah, so for a lot of things, The barrier to adopting many of these tools is the cost. And so through this incentive program, we're hoping to kind of ease the financial barrier of buying a fence and installing one, as well as kind of make the process a little less overwhelming. So we do work with people to help them figure out what they need to install the fence and really help them get started so that isn't quite so overwhelming. But we reimburse residents and property owners throughout Southeast Alaska for 50% of the total cost of an electric fence. We have a $500 maximum reimbursement amount for per person slash per project. And so what that means is if you build a fence around your garden 1 year, and then in future years you realize I need to replace a part of it, or maybe you got chickens and you're realizing you need to extend it and add on to it, you can take part in the program again.
Oh, okay. That's awesome. And how big of a fence, or what are you people usually protecting? You're talking about gardens or animals. It doesn't need to be around necessarily your whole yard per se, right?
No, yeah, you can just build it directly around the attractant itself. So you don't need to fence in, you know, your entire house. You could just do your garden plot and area, or your chicken coop. If you free range your chickens, you can build your fence in such a way that it's around the entire area where they would be free from the coop, sort of hanging out in your yard. So there's a lot of options for how you can set up an electric fence. And that's something that we can talk about when you contact us about the program, is what kind of design is going to work best for you, whether you want a temporary fence, a permanent fence, what kind of energizer is going to be ideal for your situation. We talk about all those things to help you get started.
Yeah, I can imagine people are fencing in their compost area or their garbage cans, mm-hmm. or whatever the problem areas might be that the bears would be getting into. And how difficult is the process of application?
I think it's pretty simple. You just need to email us or give us a phone call. Yeah, so there's no kind of application that you need to fill out. It's really just reaching out to us via phone number or through our email, letting us know you're interested in the program. And then I'll work with you from there to send you all the documents that you'll need for when you're ready to be reimbursed, and get you set up with the information that you'll need to actually go out and start buying parts for your fence and start the installation.
And is this something that I can do? I can get that information on the website, or do you want to give the email and phone number here on the air?
I can give them right here on the air. They are also available on our website and on the brochure that you've got pulled up there as well on one of the back pages. But our email is alaskadefenders@defenders.org. And our phone number is 907-276-9453.
Okay, great. Yeah.
And we do have a P.O. box as well listed on our brochure. We've had some earlier versions of this brochure around in communities, but we did recently go fully remote. So our old office that's on some of our older brochures is no longer correct. So for anyone who is looking to take part in the program and you have a brochure that lists an office that is not a PO, if you want to submit documents through the mail, you should use this PO box.
The PO box. And when does the program, what's the best time for me to apply? Can I do it any time, or is there a specific period of time that we want to be within?
You can do it at any time. Yeah. And we don't have time constraints as to when you have to have a fence built when you contact us. So you can contact me this year. And if you can't build something until next summer, that's totally fine. We operate our reimbursements on a first come, first serve basis. So once you reach out to us, I add you to our reimbursement waitlist. And then I'm able to reimburse you as soon as you are ready to be reimbursed. So when you're able to send me your receipts, you know, your W-9, this incentive form that's on the back of this brochure, and some photos of your fence, I'll be able to start working on the forms and get your reimbursement to you.
Basically, it seems like you're providing an incentive of up to $500 of reimbursement for this fence to get people making this happen a little bit more. And as we heard in that Sounds Wild piece, some people feel, and I think we talked about this last summer too, Isabel, but some people feel like, oh, the electric fence is bad, or we don't want to shock the animals. Can you speak to the safety of that, or to the rightness of having an electric fence?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is modern electric fences are designed to be non-injurious to both people and wildlife. So even though the shock is something that's painful to bears, ultimately it's not going to cause them any long-term harm. And I think the harm that eating human food causes them and the long-term consequences of that is far more serious than that kind of short-term initial shock. Because not only do food-conditioned and habituated bears wind up dead eventually, eating human foods is also not really good for bears, for their health, for their reproductive ability. And so sometimes the complications of that could be fatal to bears as well. So
electric fencing
is really a great way to protect bears. Sorry to cut you off.
No, it's okay. I was going to say, let's be real, Isabel. Eating some of the human food that we eat isn't good for us, actually, either. Some of the food
exactly,
that's
available. Yeah.
So imagine all of that in your trash can, and they're getting into that and eating that after you've already ingested some of those terrible chemicals. But anyway, we could all learn lessons, I guess, from what we should be eating. That's wonderful. It's Defenders of Wildlife. Is there anything else about the program that we need to mention, Isabel, that we didn't get to?
I think I would just briefly go over the reimbursement process as well, so people can get kind of an introduction to that.
Yeah.
But that's another really, I hope, easy part and simple part for people. When you're ready to be reimbursed, once your fence has been built, you'll just send us this incentive form that's on the back of the brochure, and I will also send you a copy of that when you reach out to us, a W-9, and then just photos of all of your receipts, as well as 3 to 5 photos of your fence. And the photos are great because they not only help us verify that you built a fence, but they're also a way that I can kind of double check your fence design, make sure that nothing looks kind of obviously out of place, can catch any mistakes there. So kind of a final checkpoint before we sort of send you on your way to help make sure that you've got something that's going to be effective and reliable.
That's cool. Well, I look forward to hearing more about it again next summer, hopefully, Isabel, as we remind people
would love to come back.
That Electric Fence Incentive Program is available. You just have to go to defenders.org/got-bears, or just go to defenders.org. I'm sure you can learn more about the organization there. And, of course, there's a link to that specific page. And reach out to Isabel. You can email her or call, and they'll get you set up with an electric fence, which is kind of cool. Thank you so much for being here today, Isabel. I'm glad Anchorage has some good weather. Really appreciate you coming on the program. Gunnath Cheese for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for having me for another year, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity to talk to you again next year. So thank you.
Excellent. Have a great day. Okay, this is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Here's a savory moment.
Step in to the savory moment. Maybe you've heard of the indigenous seafood staple roe on kelp or roe on branches, the eggs of Pacific herring that attach themselves to submerged seaweed fronds or hemlock boughs in nubbly white carpets placed along Southeast Alaska coastlines each spring. Harvesters pull these small, pearl-like orbs, each enclosing a drop of rich brine from the ocean, skiffs bobbing alongside what looks like a field of snowy shrubs floating beneath the water. Once harvested, the eggs, along with their kelp or branches, are hung in the sun to dry, tucked into freezers, or folded post-haste into a crunchy, creamy salad with add-ins like peas and tomatoes. Herring eggs have customarily been a source of oil, a trading commodity, and an important part of long-held cultural traditions. A group of indigenous knowledge holders, scientists, and artists called the Pacific Sea Garden Collective invites you to think about roe-on kelp or branches in a new, or perhaps more accurately, a very old way, as an aquatic garden. Indigenous people from Southeast Alaska harvest seaweed and tree branches each spring, then relocate them to sheltered bays, secure them with lines or weights, and establish boundaries with additional seaweed to create tranquil ponds that attract spawning fish. Herring prefer calm beaches with plentiful substrate for their eggs, and this is exactly what sea gardens provide. According to the Indigenous Aquaculture Collaborative Network, herring egg gardens are closely tied to ecosystem stewardship. In traditional harvests, a portion of egg-laden branches or kelp is left behind in each year's plot to ensure that future generations of fish will hatch, grow, and return to renew the Pacific herring cycle of life. Find a link to the article Herring Egg Gardens of the Northwest Coast and a recipe for herring egg salad at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. With cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Support comes from Juneau Compost, recycling the community's food scraps and yard debris into compost since 2017, serving households, businesses, offices, and more with curbside collection and drop-off options. Online at junocompost.com.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram pages. Have you ever thought of or know someone who is interested in early childhood development, but don't know where to get started or how to go about next steps? Well, the Southeast Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children, otherwise known as AEYC, has a child care apprentice program that may be for you. And after a successful first cohort, they are now looking for more folks to go through the program. I'm joined now in dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I have Blue Shibler, who's the executive director of the AEYC, as well as Tess Olympia, the success coordinator at AEYC. Gunath Chish Wasiyati, how are you today, Blue?
Great. Thanks for having us.
Of course. And Tess Wasiyati, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
Absolutely wonderful. So you were all here a couple years ago when we were launching this program with the first cohort. Blue, how did it go?
Amazing. I have to say that my main role in the success of the cohort was hiring Tess to design it. She really started from scratch. We didn't have any models to follow in the state for childcare. There are apprenticeship programs in lots of other sectors, but childcare was new. And after she and I both have worked in the sector for a really long time, and we just really thought that childcare providers and early educators would appreciate this more formal professional track to be on. So
right on. Well, yeah. I went to the executive director first, but great for you shouting out your employee here. So Tess, tell me first, I'm so curious with your title, what is a success coordinator? What does that job description look like?
Yeah, well, at first I was just a program coordinator, but as we got started, I decided to change my title to success coordinator because that better matched what my role really was supporting apprentices through their program and really to lead to their success. And everything I do is for their success.
That's awesome. Okay, so let's talk about this program. It's called the Child Care Apprenticeship Program. So Tess, tell me what that is. And what it was entailed in this first, let's start with what it is. What is this program?
Yeah, so there's lots of different kinds of registered apprenticeship programs, and this one specifically is for childcare. And that means that that anyone who becomes an apprentice has to have 2,000 hours or more of on-the-job learning to complete the apprenticeship, and they have to have classes at the same time, so they're earning an occupational endorsement certificate in infant and toddler development through UAA. So there's a competency portion, a time portion, and an education portion, and they have a mentor that helps them integrate their coursework into the classroom, so it really embeds a lot of the learning into practices that they're able to build skills with.
So are people? So people are going to school. They're learning in this. What's the title of that degree again?
It's an OEC, or Occupational Endorsement Certificate in Infant and Toddler Development.
Okay, so it's a certificate that you're getting at the same time that you are working and getting hours accumulated to get up to the 2,000 to be accredited or whatever it is, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. I see. So how many people went through the program in this first cohort?
We started with 5 and we ended with 4, and those 4 graduated in May with their certificates after it was an 18-month of coursework that they did. And,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an investment, right? Because I'm thinking about people who, you know, like, what's the difference between this childcare apprenticeship program and, let's say, somebody trying to do, you know, be a teacher for kindergarten or first grade? Because it's earlier than that, right? We're talking about toddlers and infants and that kind of childcare program. So what is the kind of person who wants to invest in that, I guess. I'm looking at, like, who's doing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is with infants and toddlers and preschoolers, and it is very different than elementary school education. Yeah. It really takes somebody who is nurturing, kind, loves to play and laugh. It's a lot of time spent moving children from place to place and making sure that they all have what they need, getting them food and, you know, all of those basic needs met. But then also through the program, they're learning about the developmental stages that they're going through. And so they can tailor specific activities to really enhance some of that development, whether it's gross motor for infants, getting them to, like, crawl across the floor, or it's preschoolers doing puzzles to get some cognitive skills going, or matching things and all kinds of stuff.
Awesome. Now, what's your background in the childcare development area?
Yeah, I've been in the field for quite a while at this point. I taught preschool for about 10 years in Washington, and then I came up to Alaska, and I immediately jumped into a Head Start program and was there for a few years as well. And then I ended up here.
What drew you to this area in terms of working with kids?
Well, I never thought that I wanted to work with children. And my aunt ran an art preschool, and so I just started working for her, and I totally fell in love with preschoolers. They are so funny, they're learning language, and they have all kinds of new things to say, and it was just so much fun that I stayed in the field and I never left.
And they kind of keep you on your toes, I would think, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and is there any particular, you know, theory involved in this kind of education? I'm thinking of things like, you know, when my daughter was really, really young, we got her started in sort of Waldorf preschool, right? In terms of the ways of learning and the ways of educating really young children. Is there a specific philosophy that this program is following, or that degree program follows?
This program is really open to all types of different pedagogies, and the certificate education really, like, kind of highlights different types as well throughout the classes.
Yeah, I'm thinking about people who might be wanting to do it, and if they have a theory or an idea of how, you know, they think it might be done, or they want to bring in that sort of Waldorf thinking or some other kind of, you know, psychology around it, which is kind of interesting. Blue, what's the importance of having more educators in this early childhood development area?
Well, we are experiencing a shortage of childcare in general across the state, and the biggest reason for that is that we just don't have enough workers to do the work. And so what I've learned in my experience as a childcare center owner, where I employed childcare workers, is that you have people that come to the field because, like Tess, they think it's going to be really fun and playful and engaging, which it is. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have the skills and education that you need to be successful in that environment, you kind of just don't feel great about it and you leave. And so you hear about historically high turnover rates in childcare, That's certainly one of the reasons that we don't have enough childcare in the state. And so we feel like if we give people the education, the skills through on-the-job learning, and then there's that a very important mentor piece that helps them connect that, then they put the pieces together of this is a job that I think is fun and engaging, and I'm also really good at it, and I'm successful.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is the most important outcome of this program.
I think people who end up in it for the long term, like Tess, you know, there's something that provides such a value to the children, but also to you, and you become addicted to it a little bit, right? In terms of like, and it helps you stay young, I would think, just a little bit. And Blue, what's the impact on the children themselves in terms of, you know, with or without this, you know, childhood development at that point? What's the impact to the child?
The impact of having skilled caregivers are that they are getting their developmental needs met through a happy, playful environment with caregivers that they form strong attachments to.
Mm-hmm.
And that just can change the trajectory of their whole life. And it makes them stronger learners and more connected humans and more likely to just be successful and contribute to their communities when they get older. One thing that you see in childcare environments where there's not enough skilled or educated providers is a lot of kids acting out and things like that. Those are the things that I was talking about that make people feel unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
And so if kids aren't getting their developmental needs met by somebody who knows what those needs are, then they can kind of regress to behaviors that are challenging.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering about the idea of, you know, what is there any studies or anything, Tess, that shows those who may have, you know, good childcare when they're young, how does that, does it give them skills later in life that others maybe don't have?
There are decades of research on early childhood, all pointing to the 0 to 5 age range as the most important. And that is because of the attachments that children make with their caregivers. I think that of anything, if you're not actively teaching anything, as long as you have a loving connection with the children you're working with, that will do more for them than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so true. Now, this program, Child Care Apprenticeship Program, is going into its second cohort. And so for those who might be interested, what should they do?
Yeah, there's some information on our Facebook and Instagram pages, and then also people can reach out to me directly. My email is a little bit long, but if you have a pen, you can write it down. It's tolympia@aeyc-sea.org, or you can reach out by phone at 907-419-1081.
Gotcha. Okay, and when does it start up again?
We are recruiting right now, so the application is out there, and we'll get started in August.
So because it's a school program too, right? So you're basically doing 2 9-month program, four semesters? How does that work exactly? Is that what it equates to?
Yeah. Most people finish this coursework in about 3 semesters, but then there's still the time and competency pieces that need to be met.
Oh, right. You have to
Yeah, some people do finish within that 18-month span.
Your 2,000 hours,
yeah,
and whatnot. Because you may not be having a job at this right away. You might be getting some skills in the classes and then get a job in that area, right? And do you help place people into specific areas that they can get this 2,000 hours?
Yeah, in this last cohort, we did help place people in their on sites, and that worked really well. And I just do want to give a big shout out to all of the apprentices who joined our program when it was brand new, and it was new to all of us, and they helped us get started, and they have been so amazing throughout, and they're just watching them grow over time has been so great.
And are they working to try to get placed into workplaces now? Is that what happens?
They're in their workplaces.
They're in there.
They've stayed. And so when we talk about retention, they've stayed in the programs pretty much that they started in. They did move around a little bit. It's important to find that right fit.
Mm-hmm.
But they've all stayed in the field, and they will actually be like the journey workers for the next cohorts.
Oh,
they can serve as mentors.
Hand down, right?
Yeah,
hand
yeah.
down.
Because
that's
they have
cool.
they have a certificate from the Office of Apprenticeship, from the Federal Office of Apprenticeship.
Oh, that's so cool. I really love that. And is there anything else that we need to mention about the program that people need to know? Do you have to have any prerequisites or anything?
Nope, no prerequisites, but people should know that tuition is free and paid for, and we provide all of the books and laptops and everything that they need for those classes, and there are opportunities for childcare to be covered as long as there's space available, but the cost can be covered as well. So we try to make it as cost-free to the participants as possible.
Wow, that's huge, actually,
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
So if somebody's looking for a career change or is young or trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, they can get this training if you want to work with young children.
Mm-hmm.
That is so cool. That's a big piece.
Yeah.
That's giant. That's so good. Okay. Give a shout out one more time to the website where people can get information and where they should go. And they should do it soon because it's starting up really quick in like a month or so.
Yeah. The website is aeyc-sea.org. And then we also have a Facebook and Instagram that people can find us on as well.
Awesome. That's so good. And Blue, did I hear a rumor that are you all changing your name?
Yes, we are.
Eventually, right?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Right. Well, we've announced it. We're morphing into something called the Southeast Childhood Collective.
Ah.
We're just still working on like the business aspects of it before we like formally make the change.
I see. I got you. That makes sense. Okay. Excellent. I heard that. I wanted to verify because it'll make the website easier probably in the long run.
Yeah.
Someday.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, it's the Child Care Apprenticeship Program. It's happening now. If you want to get signed up, if you're interested in working with kids or know somebody who's interested in looking for that that career, this may be the opportunity. And you can reach out to tolympia@aeyc-sea.org or give them a call. You can find their phone number on the website at aeyc-sea.org. I'm so excited for the second cohort. You'll have to come back again in a couple years and tell us how that one went because the program is just going to keep on growing and growing. I'm going to thank you for being here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, we will talk to Chief Derek Boss from the Chuno Police Department. But first, this week's edition of Our Living Lands from Native Voice One.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the climate crisis worsens, the very ground on which some indigenous communities built their homes is shifting before their eyes. New Orleans Public Radio's Eva Tesfaye looked at how tribes in Alaska and Louisiana are losing their land to climate change, forcing them to make tough decisions about whether to stay or to leave. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to her about the story.
Can you talk about why you and Sage Smiley decided to focus on Nunavichuk in Alaska and Point Ocean in Louisiana?
We had already noticed a lot of similarities generally about how climate change is impacting Louisiana and Alaska. And we also noticed that relocation is something that the tribes in both places were thinking about. And so part one of the episode is reported by Sage Smiley. She's the news director of KUYK up in Bethel, Alaska. And she went to this small Native Alaskan village of Nunavichuk, and they plan on relocating because this village is built on permafrost. But because of climate change and warming temperatures, that permafrost is melting, which is causing damage to houses and the town's infrastructure. Sage talked to Gertrude Lewis. She was a tribal member there.
My grandson, he stepped off the boardwalk and he went knee deep. We had to pull him off. We lost his rubber boot.
When you were a kid, could you play on the tundra?
Everywhere. Everywhere. We went everywhere.
And now you have to stay on the boardwalk.
Stay on the boardwalk.
I, on the other hand, chose to focus on Point Ocean in coastal Louisiana. They're also losing their land due to sea level rise and coastal erosion. And I knew that Point Ocean was right next to another tribal community, Ile de Jean Charles, that actually ended up relocating due to sea level rise. But Point Ocean was adamantly saying, like, we're not even considering moving. It's really important for people to hear from communities like Point Ocean to understand why people who live in these precarious places that are getting even more precarious because of climate change, like why those people want want to stay where they are.
What is Point Oshin like, and what about the place do you think makes people want to stay there?
It's really this like beautiful, like coastal, like wetland community. When I first got there and I pulled up to the marina with Sheree Mathern, we saw dolphins like immediately, like they were just right there. And it's really just a beautiful place. You can hear about it from Sheree Mathern herself. She's the tribe's cultural heritage and resiliency coordinator.
My husband is a craft fisherman, so he has caught sharks in his cage. He has caught stingrays, turtles. But yeah, so we have just this very diverse ecosystem.
Fishing is really important to people in Point Oshin. For many of them, it's not only their jobs, but it's this way of living that's been passed down from generation to generation. And basically, the area is just home, and they don't want to lose their connection to it.
What are some of the unique challenges facing indigenous people in Louisiana?
I think what's interesting about Louisiana is we have quite a few small tribes along the coast. And so the issues they're facing have a lot to do with intensifying hurricanes. And a lot of those tribes, those small tribes along the coast, don't have federal recognition. It's really hard for them to get all those resources that other towns and communities benefit from the federal government and from FEMA for relocation or adapting in place.
Are these communities and others in similar positions getting help from federal and state governments?
In 2020, the Government Accountability Office released a report, and they basically found it's really difficult for any community to use federal programs for relocation because none of them actually address climate and migration specifically. And there isn't any one federal agency that is specifically tasked with helping communities relocate. And we need that because relocation projects are really expensive. In terms of money for adapting in place, like what Point Oshin was doing, we used to have this program from FEMA called the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Program, but the Trump administration canceled it earlier this year.
What did you learn by reporting this story with another reporter from Alaska?
Reporting the story with Sage, for me, kind of revealed these connections between tribes in Louisiana and Alaska, but also that there are like huge differences. And it also made me realize relocation and adapting in place, those aren't always super different. Like Nunupachuk had to get grants to improve the infrastructure where they are, kind of like adapting in place in a way, because they're not able to move people yet. And then in Point Oshin, a lot of people are also slowly migrating, even though they're, you know, they've decided to adapt in place. So what was hopeful about the whole thing was seeing both Nunupachuk and Point Oshin being so focused on keeping their cultures and their communities together, no matter what decision they make.
That was Eva Tesfaye, Coastal Desk reporter for WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. To listen to the full episode, look up Sea Change wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Quantic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTO's YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook pages. National Night Out is an event that has been happening since 1984. It's an annual event in over 400 communities nationwide that helps to heighten awareness about anti-crime programs and connect communities together to be involved in basically their own neighborhood watch. And this year, the event is scheduled in Juneau on Wednesday, August 6th. And I'm joined now by Chief Derek Boss from the Juneau Police Department to tell us more. Gunath Chish, Wasiyati. How are you today, Chief?
Thank you much. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Excellent. Still have the best email in all existence. Da Boss. I like that.
I like it too.
D Boss with only one S, but still. So I just say Da Boss. It's kind of fun. So let's start with this National Night Out because this is a pretty cool thing. Is this newer to Juno or has it been going on for a while?
It's been going on for a while, although we didn't do it last year.
Okay.
But we've been doing it for a long time. I don't even know exactly how long. But as you said, it started in 1984. It's all across the country, police departments and communities coming together. And last year we missed it because it was the same night as we had the GLOF, the Glacial Lake flood.
Right.
So we canceled, obviously. But this year we're hoping to do the same well, actually a little different event, but
not have the outburst flood.
Not have the outburst flood. Yeah. I can't plan that one.
Yeah, we don't know.
We are, instead of going to different communities or different neighborhoods and attending different barbecues, we were trying to do everything at one location this year.
Okay.
In the past, we would just go from neighborhood to neighborhood, and we really want to emphasize relationships between the officers and the community. And mm-hmm. what we found is if we go from neighborhood to neighborhood, we get 5-10 minutes with people, and then that's it.
Mm.
So this year, we are trying to centralize everything in Twin Lakes area, at the park and probably a little beyond. And so we would like to invite people to come down. We'll have free hot dogs for the first couple of hundred people who show up.
Mm-hmm.
We've got our partners with CCFR and the Coast Guard coming and bringing all their fun toys as well as ours. And just a good hope is to have a good gathering of community and just enjoy some time together.
And this is on Wednesday, August 6th, as I mentioned. What time is it going to be at?
It is from 5 to 7.
From 5 to 7 at Twin Lakes, basically.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, all in that area. And I know that people can still have their own little kind of community event that night, because what they do is they do things with, like, leaving the lights on and doing all those kind of things. Is that part of, like, building a good neighborhood watch community?
That is.
Yeah.
We're just shifting gears a little bit this year, and our focus is more on just relationships.
Right, okay.
We want to focus on individual relationships between our neighbors and our community and the officers.
Yeah, that's great.
But as far as crime prevention goes, you know, the two easiest things to keep your house safe, lock your doors and leave your outside lights on.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you'd be surprised how many people don't do that.
Right. Not at all. But
I always thought it was amazing. I grew up in Anchorage, and my grandparents, they never locked the car. And I was like, why don't you lock the car? Because it's not even inside your house.
Right.
It's so easy for then somebody to just randomly be in your neighborhood. And it doesn't matter what part of the city you live in, I guess. And you can find out more about National Night Out at nationalnightout.org. They have great resources, and they have an awesome logo. And there's other things that you get inspired by in terms of, you know, creating something for your neighborhood, because I do think it is about relationships. It's about knowing who's coming into your neighborhood, both police-wise as well as, you know, just, you know, other neighbors that you have there.
Absolutely.
And we don't know each other as well as we used to.
Absolutely. And we're just trying to come past those walls and just get to know people again.
And it's interesting because whenever I've had yourself, you've been here since like February of last year, right?
Yep.
Was it that right? So you've
That's
been here
correct.
Like a year and a half?
Year and a half, yes,
That's
sir.
Awesome. Or when we've had Deputy Chief Craig Campbell on, we've talked about this idea that, you know, in a lot of towns around America, the police officers live in a community separate from the one that they work in. But that's pretty impossible here in Juneau.
That would be very difficult, yes.
Like, we might see you out at, you know, Boca some night, or out, you know, having lunch with your kids out at Zerelda's or something.
Absolutely, you will, and you'll run into me at Costco.
Yeah, and not in uniform. You might even recognize them. And it's just an interesting way to be part of a community, right?
Yes.
And does that change how you or the other officers interact with the community?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I think on one level, there's more respect on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a true partnership. We are here. This is not just a place we work. This is our community. This is where we're raising our kids. You know, my friends are people who live here.
Yeah.
And so I think that very much changes the dynamic. That changes our relationships. It changes how we interact with individuals. But I think the essence of that is there's more respect on both sides of the fence.
It's not often that you live in a community where you might know the first name basis of the police officer who pulls you over for speeding.
That's true.
That would be just maybe a little bit awkward.
That could be awkward, you know. And,
or not. You just go, okay, you caught me. You got me. I was a little over the line there. That's all good. But it just it does create a wonderful – I feel like it creates a wonderful sense of community for Juneau, and just how personable it is. And so this event, National Night Out, that's just a – it's a great thing to be able to say, hey, maybe I don't know the officers that are in town. I haven't been pulled over recently.
Which is good.
Which is a good thing. I haven't done anything else illegal.
That's good, too.
That's also good. But police officers interact with us in so many different ways, not just for us doing things wrong,
yes.
right? There's so many things
yes.
that happen in our community that we rely on the police officers and the other partners, the Capital
yep.
City Fire Rescue
yep.
and all of our other partners. And I know on the website you all still have listed things about being a block captain, but we're not necessarily doing that this year, right?
We're not doing that this year.
Okay. So when you're reading that on the JPD website, don't worry about that. That might
right.
come back next year. This year, everyone's getting together and being in one place at Twin Lakes on August 6th from 5 to 7 p.m. Get some hot dogs, meet the police officers, say hi. And
yes.
there might be some new officers that you get to meet because you have been recruiting actively. We talk about it a lot when you all are on the show.
Yes.
And joinjpd.com. And you're still looking for where are we at in terms of our number?
We have, as of Monday, we have 11 openings for officers.
Okay.
And you will see new faces. We've hired 12 or 13 new officers in the last year, which is great. But we still have room to add more. We're also hiring dispatchers. So if being a cop is not for you, that's okay. We have other jobs available too.
And they're all listed at joinjpd.com, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I always like to mention that. You don't necessarily have to be the one on the street doing
That's
the
right.
policing. You can just be involved in other ways. And I know, I think last time, maybe a few months in the spring, there was somebody coming from, wasn't there somebody coming from Florida who was transferring in?
We've got Florida, Louisiana, Colorado, a couple from Louisiana.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Wow.
They're all looking at the hot weather in the South saying Juneau looks way better. So.
Juneau looks pretty good. Living in a rainforest is all right with me.
Absolutely.
Now, part of the thing with the rainforest is it rains a lot, and a lot of times that can lead to more water filling up in certain places in our community. You talked about this last year that your event was on the night that the glacier outburst sort of happened.
Yep.
You're pretty close. You might be pretty close to it again this year. We'll see. We don't know.
That's
Obviously,
true.
you can't predict that stuff.
That's true.
But tell us, in terms of, from JPD's perspective, what are you all doing to prepare for this potential early August outburst?
You know, I would say a little broader than JPD. There's a lot of planning going on at the city level. Planning, preparation, and obviously we're hoping for the best with the HESCO barriers and with the flood itself to not be a big event, but we can't predict it like you said. So, you know, we're planning as much as we can ahead of time, working with all our partners. I think for the community, a key is doing your own personal planning. As many people learned last year, prioritize what you want to get out of your house, have a plan of where to go if there is an actual flood, and just stay connected with all the communication coming out. CBJ is pushing a lot of information out on their website, and as we get closer and closer to a potential release, we're using every avenue we can to communicate with the public. So. Just stay in tune and be prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. That is good. You can also follow along KTO.org. They have a lot of things going on. I think you can go to KTO.org/flood, and they're going to keep an eye on things as well and be out there and keeping people alert as to what's
yes.
happening. So that's wonderful. Anything else happening at the police department? Chief Boss.
I think that covers it.
That about covers it.
For the day, so.
That's awesome. It's National Night Out. It's part of a nationwide communities coming together this year. The police officers and other people from community, Capital City Fire Rescue and others will be at Twin Lakes on August 6th from 5 to 7 p.m. Get some hot dogs. Meet those public safety officers who are working in your community and allow them to also get to know you a little bit.
That would be great.
Awesome.
Yes.
Chief Boss, thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it. Gunnath Cheesh.
Thank you.
Here's a little Buddy Tabor with Peace Was Just a Dream I Had. Thank you.
You know what you want, but I know what you need to spread your wings and fly away from this place, be free, from this place, be free. Oh, peace was just a dream I had. Here's a feather I have found, lying there so helplessly on cold and barren ground, on cold and barren ground. The stalls are empty, the fields are fallow, there's no fruit upon the vine, but with your heart turned up toward heaven, these things may change in time, these things may change in time. Oh, peace was just a dream I had, is a feather I have found, lying there so helplessly on a cold and barren ground, on a cold and barren ground. If peace were just a small white bird and mercy was her name, I'd pray to God she'd fly to me and ease my aching pain, and ease my aching pain. It's better to light one candle then to curse the dark at night, but when you light that candle, Lord, pray for the morning light. I said, pray for the morning light. Oh, peace was just a dream I had. Here's a feather I have found, lying there so helplessly on a cold and barren ground, on a cold and barren ground.
And that will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, Marimbas with Caden Davis and Betsy Sims. Join us. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives over on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you. Never more important than now. Go to ktoo.org/donate. And also Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Grass, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gonna cheese.